That was a good start. This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey.
Nice.
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
There's more information at doucetsurvey.com. We could do it like robots.
Word of Mouth Daily Podcast, sponsored by Doucette Survey.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For many of us who have wallets bursting with payment and loyalty cards, this scenario may sound familiar. You're out shopping, you bring your items to the cash register, and face the conundrum of which card to use. The Visa, MasterCard, debit card, the store-issued credit card. Well, Apple proposes to answer that question with a swipe, provided you have an iPhone 6, that is. Last month, Apple unveiled its latest creation, Apple Pay, a mobile payment system that it claims will make purchasing easier and more secure. Some major retailers are not having it. But why? Joining us now to demystify Apple Pay is Rob Fleischman, Chief Technology Officer at Zerocoal and Word of Mouth explainer of all things Wired. Rob, great to have you with us.
Hey, great to see you again, Virginia.
So first of all, what is Apple Pay?
Okay, Apple Pay is a mobile payment system and digital wallet. So it's two things. Mobile payment, meaning it's focused on making, helping you buy things both online and at retail locations, point of sale, where
right.
you'd normally hand over your credit card or cash, at the register. And the second part is it's a digital wallet. And a digital wallet, they've been around for a little while. There are a number of people that have them. But it's just like a real wallet. What's a wallet? It's a place where you store things that you can pay for other things with, like cash and credit cards. So it's a digital way to store your payment information and a way to conduct mobile payments.
So if I am at Starbucks ordering a coffee, what happens?
Sure. Well, you have to have your iPhone 6, your iPhone 6 Plus, or the upcoming Apple Watch, because those devices have inside of them a secure element and which stores some of the secure information. And they, more importantly, have an NFC chip, a near-field communication chip. And we talked about this a year ago when they were just starting to come out. But what that does is it allows the device to talk to another system, usually a point-of-sale system, that's less than about 12 inches away. So what you do is you grab your iPhone, you'd bring it up to the point-of-sale device, you would touch or tap or get very close to the device, and then you would use your finger on the Touch ID sensor that scans your fingerprint to complete the transaction.
Okay.
And, it would basically be the equivalent of scanning your credit card.
So obviously, Apple must be in partnership with some of the big credit card companies on this. Who's on board with this as far as credit card companies and retailers?
So Apple has spent a tremendous amount of time and money designing this, testing this for security. There were over 700 engineers involved, a lot of secrecy. There are great stories about working with J.P. Morgan in closed rooms and things like that. But to answer your question, Amex, American Express, Visa, MasterCard are fully on board. They're ready to go. Some of the big banks like Bank of America, Chase, Citibank, Wells Fargo, tons of retailers, a lot of the people that you'd normally see in the mall are there, your Aeropostales, those type of stores, all kinds of retailers in terms of clothing, folks that are going to be convenient places like Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks. Those guys are all getting in line to sign up. There are a few who have held back. There's been some news about that.
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot about opposition.
Absolutely.
Who's in opposition and why, more
importantly?
Well,
the real there's been some pharmacies that have been against it. And the real opposition here, it's quite interesting. One of the big benefits about Apple Pay is the security. Security is much better. And I can go into the technology reasons why. But one of the aspects of the security is that there isn't as much data in the transmission. So when Virginia Prescott walks up and goes to Dunkin' Donuts or goes to a retailer and scans her credit card, the retailer, that business gets, well, this is Virginia Prescott.
Mm-hmm.
We know what the time is. We know what credit card she spent. We know how much she spent, and we know what she bought. So we have all that information, and that's very valuable to retailers, obviously. But Apple Pay eliminates a tremendous amount of that.
How?
Well, the way the transactions work is that once you have Apple Pay set up, what's actually in your phone is an anonymous token. A token that has no value, a token that I can hand out to bad guys, a token that if it's stored at a place like Target that's had infiltration.
Data breaches.
Data breaches, absolutely. That list of tokens has absolutely no value because those tokens are combined with something from you, your signature.
Mm-hmm.
So we have something you have, mm-hmm. your phone.
Right.
Your phone has special unique tokens that are only good inside that phone. They're not good in my phone. So if I copy them, not going to help. Combined with the Touch ID, something you are, those two get combined together in combination with a retailer. And those two kind of come together as a one-time credit card. A credit card that's good for this one and only transaction, and then that's passed through the system.
And it goes right to the credit card company.
Absolutely, right to the credit card company that actually has your credit card information and knows you're Virginia Prescott. But everyone else, all they see are these tokens, these random numbers that have no meaning and cannot be traced back to Virginia. So because all of this has no ability to be traced back to who you are or what credit card you have or what account you have, everybody along the transaction has no additional data.
So Walmart is not going to have your personal information. Target's not going to have your personal information. There's a sort of coalition of retailers that have started working on their own electronic payment systems, proprietary systems, and there's something called Currency, Current with a C. Now, what is this? These are supposed to be competitors for Apple
Absolutely.
Pay.
There are different competitors and different ways to approach this problem. The goals are really the same. It's, let's provide more security to both the retailer and the individual. So both of these systems, some of them are token-based or digital wallet-based. But the real difference is who owns the data, if there is any data to be owned, who gets paid, how much privacy is given to each part of the transaction. And there's slight differences. The big win here, though, is what does the customer have? And Apple would like you to have their phone.
Not only the Apple phone, but the most recent Apple phone.
Absolutely, Virginia. Very astute. But that is exactly what they want. They want you to have their most recent stuff. And that's the upside to Apple. Apple views it as, if we can own the platform, then we're going to win. And the payment system, yes, they're going to make some money here and there. And yes, there's a huge benefit to consumers. But I believe Apple's real motivation is to get Apple everywhere. I mean, I can imagine a system. I mean, there's all kinds of rumors about Apple TV coming up. But if Apple Pay gets popular, which I believe it will, gets ubiquitous, which I believe it will, you're sitting at home watching television on your Apple TV or maybe on some other device or maybe just on your phone, and a commercial comes up and they're selling something, and you can just hit your Touch ID button and buy it in a secure way without making a phone call, without going to a website, without doing anything. And that's quite compelling. That's a quite compelling offer.
Well, one of the things I find so interesting about this is it goes kind of contrary to all of the information that we've heard about how data is being collected on individuals and the purchases they make and these kind of profiles, these data profiles that are created about us. Is this reversing that process, and is that something that Apple is specifically trying to do?
Well, it's certainly a reverse here. This is going to make a lot of retailers and a lot of people that make money off of retail data very upset. There's a lot more to collecting data than just the actual transaction, right? I mean, when you're mousing around Amazon.com, they know a lot about you before you actually submit your credit card and hit buy.
Right, all the things you look at.
Absolutely. And so Amazon, as the vendor, will certainly know what you bought without getting that data from the transaction.
So Walmart, Target, Best Buy, CVS, these are all companies who are right now taking a stand and saying we're opposing Apple Pay.
Yeah, they're going to fold.
Is that what I was going to ask your prediction?
I absolutely think they're going to fold. I'm very close to pounding the table here because as a technologist, I look at security. And what do we got today? We got the mag stripe on the back of your credit card. Virginia, I walk over, I take the credit card out of your wallet. In 15 minutes, I've run up charges all over town and online. With Apple Pay, I just can't do it. I just can't do it. And I'm a great technologist, and it's incredibly hard. And that's why I like it. I'll go on record. This is the most secure payment system I've ever seen.
All right. I believe you. But Apple also said it was your photographs that you put up on the cloud were secure. Now, ask Jennifer Lawrence what she thinks of that.
No, you're right. I mean, it goes back to the basic authentication. In computer science, authentication is about three things. It's about something you have, something you know, something you are, or combinations of the two. So your credit card, something you have. Your cloud, something you know. Your password, somebody guesses it. Somebody steals it, the authentication is gone. Great thing about Apple Pay, it's a combination. Something you have, your phone, but something you are, the scan of your Touch ID. Those two combine together to make the security much better. So I agree with you. The cloud is secure, but if somebody finds out the thing you know, that security's gone.
Are we going to start seeing we accept Apple Pay decals all over town?
I think within 6 months to a year, we're going to see that all over town.
Rob Fleischman is Chief Technology Officer at Zerocall, and he's also Chief Explainer of all things technological and digital for us here on Word of Mouth. Rob, always great to have you in.
Always great to be here, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
You may have heard in the news late last month that a rocket set to resupply the International Space Station exploded shortly after takeoff.
And launch team, be advised, stay at your consoles. Everyone in the elevator.
Only days later, a pilot was killed in the crash of Virgin Galactic's Spaceship Two. Spaceflight is hard, said Virgin Galactic's founder, Sir Richard Branson, but worth it. Many space tourism enthusiasts would agree, even after these significant setbacks. In this piece, produced long before those accidents, Julie Sabatier investigates the DIY mindset, aiming to prove that you don't have to be a multi-billionaire to reach space.
Suit pressurization solenoid switch on.
Confirmed.
Connect coolant hose.
We're going to wait and confirm after suit up.
These guys are getting ready to test out a spacesuit, but they're not in a NASA laboratory or Virgin Galactic HQ. They're in Cameron Smith's ground floor studio apartment in Portland, Oregon.
As technology over the last 40-odd years has become much cheaper, much more available and better, you can essentially build a do-it-yourself space program today, and now, luckily, I'm part of that.
Hundreds of people have plunked down as much as $200,000 for trips with up-and-coming space tourism companies like Virgin Galactic and X-Corps. And those flights aren't even happening yet. At the far end of the do-it-yourself space race are people like Cameron. He's building a real, honest-to-goodness spacesuit for under $2,000. He's not an engineer. Actually, he teaches anthropology at Portland State University.
Showing that it's possible to do it cheaply is, I guess, my part of this larger movement of opening space up to many rather than few.
At NASA, we love to see innovators and entrepreneurs from across the country thinking about applying their passion and their energy towards space problems.
That's Jen Gostetic. She works for NASA, and while she's trained as an engineer, she's currently in charge of the agency's crowdsourcing efforts, like the Centennial Challenges. They give away millions of dollars in prizes to amateur and commercial ventures alike. Cameron isn't looking for prize money, though. His spacesuit is a completely independent project. He's been working on it for about 3 years, and he recently started doing weekly tests with a small team of student volunteers.
Shipbox, BG levers 1, 2, and 3 open.
BG levers 1, 2, and 3 are open.
They check off items on an exhaustive list, making sure the breathing gas, pressure gas, and suit coolant are all in place. Underneath the suit, Cameron wears an old pair of long johns with plastic hoses sewn into it. That's so ice-cold water can run through the plastic tubing and keep him from overheating inside the spacesuit. But first, he has to actually put the thing on. He starts out on the floor, where he wriggles and shimmies his way into the suit's outer layers.
So right now, I'll just put my leg up like that, and Ben can start getting my foot down in there. Ben, I blocked the inhale valve on the ONM. You can inhale, but you can't exhale. It's a minor problem. We will fix it.
That doesn't sound like a minor problem.
What I mean is that the mechanism is so simple that I believe it can be fixed. We just haven't got the solution yet.
Once he's worked out all the kinks, Cameron plans to take his hand-sewn suit up to 50,000 feet in an open gondola attached to a balloon. He'll also be making that himself. At that height, Cameron will experience space-like conditions. Jen Gostetic explained that he'd have to go up a lot higher to reach outer space, or what's called the Kármán line.
A line that's roughly 100 kilometers above the Earth's surface at sea level.
That's about 328,000 feet.
And it's roughly the boundary between the Earth's atmosphere and outer space. As we humans start exiting our own atmosphere, it becomes much more important for us to maintain the pressure on our bodies to stay alive.
Once you get up above even 10,000 feet, you have to start worrying about decompression sickness.
And that's what you get from going from sea level to high altitude, less pressure, and you decompress. Your body starts to swell up. Nitrogen bubbles in your tissues start to come out of solution, and they give you the bends. It's just what divers get.
A suit with even 3 pounds of pressure per square inch can keep a person healthy in high-altitude conditions. And that's about what Cameron's suit holds on a good day. He's worked hard to try and close off all the leaks, but it's an ongoing process.
At the end of the day, suits leak. They always have, they always will.
Keith Cowing worked for NASA in the 90s. His website, spaceref.com, keeps up with what governments, private companies, and individuals are doing when it comes to outer space.
At some point, though, you need to pump the suit up with air and put it in a pool and see if there's any bubbles coming out. I mean, that's one of the oldest and yet most accurate ways to look for leaks.
Yeah, one of the most thrilling tests was I went to my brother's place in Beaverton, and he has a swimming pool, and I pressurized the suit and sat down there underwater for about 10 minutes. The thing that I had built was supporting my life. That felt really good.
According to Keith, Cameron is just one in a long line of scrappy innovators.
The first balloonists, the first people to build airplanes, the first people to build pressure suits, they're all, you know, doing stuff in their garages. They were hackers. With the advent of the internet and 3D printers and a lot of open sourcing, crowdsourcing, it's sort of a natural aha moment for a lot of people.
The private space industry is booming right now. Cameron recently got connected with another DIY team, Copenhagen Suborbitals. They're building rockets and space capsules in an abandoned shipyard in Denmark.
Tight.
These guys want to get up at least as far as the Kármán line in a suborbital flight. Like Alan Shepard, they'll go up and come right back down again, rather than orbiting the Earth like John Glenn. Copenhagen Suborbital's co-founder, Christian von Bengtsson, is talking to Cameron about building suits for them to use once they're ready to replace their crash test dummy with a live human being. Christian's approach to building his space capsule is right in line with what Cameron is doing with his suit.
A lot of the stuff we're buying is, you know, the Danish equivalent to Home Depot.
Take, for example, the heat shields. NASA has used some pretty fancy materials like reinforced carbon and high-purity silica fiber to create heat shields for the shuttle and other vehicles.
For the space capsule, we have a heat shield made of cork, which is just bought at a local carpet shop.
Did you say cork, like C-O-R-K?
Exactly. And a lot of people find it funny that we use cork as a heat shield, and it might be a bit funny, but it's the perfect solution for it.
It's one thing to fix your own plumbing or build a chicken coop in your backyard, but this is a whole new level of DIY.
You weigh the risks, and, you know, at the end of the day, it's a personal decision.
Whether or not he'd actually get into one of these handcrafted capsules, Keith Cowing has enormous respect for the DIY side of the space industry.
The history of space exploration is replete with people having to fix stuff on a moment's notice and become engineers, even if they aren't engineers. And what the Copenhagen Suborbital guys are doing, what this fellow with a spacesuit, is in the keeping in the grandest traditions of space exploration. And indeed, without it, we would not have gotten as far as we have gotten.
While the private space industry's big players are motivated by the end product, the DIYers are driven by the high-stakes challenge itself.
It would be so embarrassing to get killed in it, you know. So I'm going to make it work.
For guys like Cameron, the goal is simply showing the world that they can get to outer space using their own ingenuity and the tools they have on hand. I'm Julie Sabatier.
And that piece was part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Stay with us for the future of transportation on the ground. Our connected cars with built-in cameras and Wi-Fi putting Big Brother in the passenger seat. That story when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From cameras at traffic lights to the Easy Pass lane to dash cams, Big Brother is riding with us, whether we realize it or not. But just how much are drivers being monitored and who's benefiting from the surveillance? And is it worth trading in privacy for safety and convenience? Jamie Page Deaton is managing editor of U.S. News & World Report Best Car Rankings. She explores these questions in an article called How Big Brother Gets in Your Car. Jamie Page Deaton, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the most ubiquitous example. These are the traffic cameras. Advocates say they increase road safety,
Critics say they are revenue generators for cities. How about privacy?
For privacy, you know, these traffic light cameras have a big impact on privacy because basically if you've got a network of cameras throughout a city, they can track where a car's going. And it used to be, you know, when these traffic cameras first came out, they would just take a picture of your license tag at a very specific spot on the road after you had, say, run a red light or, you know, made a right turn on red when you weren't allowed to. Today's cameras can actually pan and follow a car for over 100 yards. And then some cities are really getting into issues with privacy advocates over what they're using these cameras for because, again, it used to be they were just snapping a picture. Now they can provide live feeds to law enforcement. And, of course, we don't know how secure those feeds are. And, of course, civil liberties advocates and privacy advocates are saying, you know, law enforcement really shouldn't just be monitoring cameras unless they have a very good reason.
Wow. Well, you know, for people who are concerned about privacy online, they might use DuckDuckGo instead of Google, for example, or maybe use an encrypted phone. Is there any way to opt out of a traffic cam?
No, not really. I mean, there are a couple of aftermarket products, which I would not recommend at all, but there are supposedly sprays that you can put on your license tag that make it tough to read for a traffic camera. But beyond that, I mean, we're being surveilled everywhere you go. I mean, there are cameras in stores. There are cameras on sidewalks. And of course, this depends in large part on what city you live in. But this is something that you really can't opt out of because, you know, government has decided that the loss of privacy for the citizens is worth what is seen as an increase in safety and the ability to prevent and fight crime.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about insurance. Monitoring devices are being placed in cars. Tell us about the devices that car insurance companies actually are using to monitor driving habits.
Yeah, this is the main one is a program called Snapshot from Progressive. It's a small device that plugs into your car, and it sends things to Progressive that lets them help determine your rate. So the way they market it as is that this is a device that if you're a safe driver, you should get a lower rate. And so it measures how hard you brake, how fast you accelerate, and in some cases will actually monitor your location. It also monitors how many miles you're driving, and it allows Progressive then to say, okay, well, this is somebody who drives fairly safely, so let's give them a lower rate. The issue with it is this could be hacked, and the data could be sent elsewhere besides Progressive. And in some cases, Progressive admits that they are monitoring, you know, the geographic areas that people are driving in. Now, there have been no reported cases of Progressive, say, redlining somebody's insurance rates because they park their car, say, in an unsafe neighborhood overnight. But that's one thing that could the company could actually look into. The other issue is, you know, Progressive has a very long privacy statement on their website. They're obviously working very hard. They say, you know, to protect the user's privacy. But, I mean, that's what Home Depot was doing. That was what Chase was doing. That's what Target was doing as well. These things are not invulnerable. And your data could essentially, you know, go out and be used by who knows who.
Well, it may tell you what kind of driver I am that I first thought, why would anyone put that in their car? But if you are a good driver, you would get a better rate.
Yeah.
There's an advantage there.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to save money on car insurance, I mean, and you want to, you know, use your good driving habits to make sure that you can get a deal, then yeah, it sounds like a great idea. But again, this is a fairly simple tracker. And I mean, it's probably not that far off from something, though, that you could actually buy and, say, monitor your teen's driving habits. Or for if you wanted to, say you wanted to monitor a romantic partner, see where they're going, you could possibly get a device like this and use it in their car.
Wowie. Well, perhaps the most unsettling case besides those of Big Brother monitoring has to do with the car lending industry. Now, what types of technologies are lenders using?
Lenders are using devices similar to the Progressive Snapshot device that not only monitors miles driven and things like that, but can actually immobilize and lock a car's engine if a person falls behind on their payments.
Wow, falls behind by how much?
Well, in some cases, they're getting a lot of complaints about these. In some cases, as late as 2 or 3 days.
Wow. So you'd go to start your car and it wouldn't start?
It wouldn't start at all. And now, these lending companies say that they have, you know, if you have an emergency, you can call them and get a code to start the car. A lot of users are saying this hasn't worked, and they've been trapped, say, with a sick kid and been unable to take it to the doctor because their car won't start. There have even been reports of the lending company shutting down the cars while they're in motion, which is, of course, incredibly unsafe.
Boy.
Now, of course, these lending companies and these companies that make these devices say that has never happened. However, However, they have settled out of court with people who have made those claims.
Is it legal? I mean, even repo men have to have 30 days until a loan falls into default, don't they, before repossessing a car?
Well, this is a gray area. They're not repossessing the car. They're just preventing you from using it. And so they see it as a very, a big tool for them, making sure that they're getting their payments on time. And of course, you know, you talk about the repo man. The repo man used to have to go and find your car, which was expensive and time-consuming. These devices shut down the car and say, hey, repo man, I'm parked over here on Main Street. Come pick me up.
Wow. Any efforts to regulate this?
Well, I mean, you know, this is like most issues of technology. The technology is way ahead of regulation. And so this is something that, you know, that different states are going to have to look into and figure out how they want to regulate it, if they want to regulate it at all.
I'm imagining this is just going to increase as we enter the era of the connected, you know, the era of the connected car to self-driving cars. Mm-hmm. Isn't that going to just up the ante for surveillance?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there is Mary Barra has an op-ed in the Washington Post today, and she was talking about how we need to really invest in vehicle-to-vehicle technology as well as vehicle-to-infrastructure technology if we want these self-driving cars. And vehicle-to-vehicle technology is basically a signal that your car is sending out saying, hey, here I am. The other cars can read that signal and say, I'm over here too, and they can communicate. And then vehicle-to-infrastructure technology allows your car to communicate with traffic lights or with the roadway so it can closely monitor conditions and things like that. But you've got to think, if your car is constantly sending out a signal saying, hey, here I am, you are also sending out a signal saying, I'm right here as well.
We think of the car maybe as a place to get into and get away to escape, you know, our world online. Do you think people are aware of how much they're actually being watched in their cars?
Probably not. Yeah. Your car, I mean, unless you've got a very old car and you're not carrying your cell phone with you when you get in it, you are easily trackable. And I mean, even if you aren't carrying your cell phone and you are in an old car, you better stay off roads with Easy Pass. You better stay off roads with cameras. And basically, you know, that's it. You are out and about. You are visible. You can easily be tracked with
your car.
So
you basically stay on a country roads in New Hampshire. Are there any upsides, Jamie, of having Big Brother in your car?
There are some, actually. One of those is with the telematic system, which makes it easily for you to be found if in case of an accident. Now, these telematic systems, OnStar is the one from GM, Hyundai has BlueLink, Mercedes has Embrace. All sorts of car companies are putting these in because of consumer demand. And not only do they allow, say, your car to be found if it's stolen, which is a huge help, but if you are in an accident and it senses that the airbags have gone off, it can automatically notify emergency responders, which, you know, if you're driving in a country road in New Hampshire, you spin out in the snow, you're incapacitated, just looking for someone, that could take a couple of days for somebody to find you if you're really out in a remote area. But if the car's sending out a signal saying, I've been in an accident, please send help, here's my exact location, you're going to get help a lot faster. And for a lot of people, that peace of mind is worth it.
And as you mentioned, for monitoring kids, for example.
Oh, Hyundai's BlueLink system is actually a teenager's worst nightmare. Kids, if your parents want to buy you a Hyundai, say maybe we'll pass on that. Because what they can do is they can set up a geographic fence so that if the car goes outside of a certain area, the owner gets an email or a text message. If it goes over a certain speed, mom and dad will know. So that's something that, from a parenting perspective, well, that sounds pretty good. But, from a privacy perspective and a kid's perspective, well, hey, that's kind of infringing on my rights a little bit.
Well, Jamie Page Deaton, thank you, I think, for letting us know what's going on. It's a little unsettling.
You're welcome.
Jamie Page Deaton, managing editor of U.S. News Best Car Rankings. You'll find a link to her article, How Big Brother Gets in Your Car. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Now imagine this. You're driving your car down a street, and as you pass, a camera takes a photo of your license plate. Who is taking the photo, and what are they doing with that information? Reporter Cyrus Farivar of Life of the Law podcast brings us the story.
If it weren't for the photograph, Mike Katzlikabe probably wouldn't remember being in his driveway on November 14th, 2009.
The timing was just magnificent, where my daughters and I were getting out of the car in our driveway, and there is a very clear image of that. You can recognize all of us getting out of the car in the driveway.
The photograph was taken by the police in San Leandro, California. Or more accurately, by an automatic camera on the top of a San Leandro patrol car. Mike Katzlikabe works in the computer industry. He's been on the San Leandro school board since 2006. In his spare time, he enjoys hiking with his daughters. He's never been convicted of a crime. He's not a suspect in any case. And yet, the San Leandro Police Department has what amounts to a family photo album of him and his car. More than 100 pictures were taken between 2008 and 2010.
There was one of me by the library. There was one of my car parked in front of a friend's house.
And if you drive a car and live in an American city, well, your local police department probably has an album of you too. About a decade ago, law enforcement started widely using license plate readers to track cars. These specialized cameras scan every single car that passes in front of them and automatically check that license plate against a hot list of stolen cars. Police can use that information to pull a car over or just keep the information, sometimes forever.
So the effectiveness of our current license plate readers.
Sandra Spagnoli is the police chief in San Leandro. At a city council meeting last fall, she explained how the city has been using its three license plate readers.
In January 2013, we had a wanted felon arrested after we got a hit from the license plate reader. In identifying that a sex offender over a period of a year had been violating his terms of probation by running his license plate and found that he was several times located at or near a park where youth were playing, which was a violation of his parole or probation. So it is an effective tool.
She says using cameras has helped reduce crime all around the Bay Area.
Some of the other Bay Area cities that are using license plate readers and public safety cameras are San Francisco, Pittsburgh, Fairfield, Martinez, and Richmond. The city of Pittsburgh, and looking at their system, since 2005, overall violent crime has declined about 47%.
The question is, as with much of law enforcement, is how to balance protecting a community with protecting our constitutional right to privacy. Linda Lai is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California.
Does it invade reasonable expectations of privacy for the police to monitor our whereabouts when we're in public spaces?
The Fourth Amendment, that's the one that protects us from illegal search and seizure, is usually interpreted to mean that there is no reasonable expectation of privacy in public, including driving a car on a public road. And so far, courts have mostly upheld the right to use information from license plate readers as evidence. But having a police officer notice you driving by is very different from a camera that can track 60 cars per second. License plate readers give police enough information to get a fairly accurate, if rough, picture of where a car, and presumably its driver, go over time.
In the pre-technological era, in addition to the Fourth Amendment, resources was a basic natural protection for privacy, that law enforcement simply didn't have the resources to compile detailed information about us unless they had a very good reason. Now it can be done on the basis of mere idle curiosity.
And in the future, that idle curiosity could yield a lot more information, as new technology makes it easier to track us, and to track us more accurately. For Life of the Law, I'm Sarus Varavar.
And Word of Mouth returns with another example of how technology is changing the way that we experience and see the world. We're going to take a closer look at Auto Awesome. That's a new Google feature that combines disparate photos into one perfectly gorgeous and completely fabricated moment. Stay with us.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Say cheese! If you've ever been behind the camera for a family photo, you know that there's always somebody blinking or not smiling or making a silly face when you take the shot. Digital photography allows us to take countless versions of the same shot, but you still have to go through all the rejects and pick the best one, right? Not anymore. Enter Google's default photo feature, Auto Awesome. Now a computer can not only pick the best shot, but also combine photos into one perfect moment, one that never actually existed. Our next guest thinks that's not so awesome. Robert Elliott Smith is a teaching fellow at University College in London. He's in the Department of Computer Science, and he wrote an essay on his blog called It's Official, AIs Are Now Rewriting History. Robert, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Nice to be here.
Describe your experience with Google's Auto Awesome.
Well, it all started when we were in a little bistro in France with my father-in-law, who's not very good with little devices. And I handed him my iPhone and said, take a picture of me and my wife. And he held down the button for a long time. It took about 24 pictures or something. And when I got home, I was uploading them into an album, and I decided my wife might like one of them. She might like the other. So I uploaded just two from that burst of 24. And then a few hours later, I got an email from Google saying Auto Awesome has done some Auto Awesome things to your photos. So I went and looked, and it had done some nice kind of Instagram-like filters and things here and there. But there was this one strange picture that had a in the corner, it said smile with some little sparkles around it. And I looked at it, my wife looked at it, and we couldn't figure out what was strange about it. And then I went back and looked at the two originals and found out that neither one of them were actually the photo that I was sent. And in fact, my wife's smile had been plastered on her a different face. From a different picture, and effectively it had married together two different smiles from the both of us, which I found awesomely creepy.
It does sound a little creepy, I have to say. How does this algorithm actually work?
Well, I imagine what it does, and I have to imagine here because I'm not at Google, but I imagine what it does is it basically looks for photos that have almost all the pixels in common, and if it finds those, then it says, can I find any smiles in these pictures? And then it looks at all the things that look like some template of smiles. And then it basically says, well, take all the best smiles from all of them and put them all in the same photo.
Where did you upload this again that Google sort of took it upon itself to auto-awesomate your photo?
Google Plus upload of photos to its photo area.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Well, you do mention in the essay, however, Robert, that cameras have always been a fictitious view of the world. What makes Auto Awesome creepier or different?
Well, in my opinion, there is a difference between this and, say, adjusting the white balance in your photos, because although white balance is not ever the way it really is in real life, the smile is like a symbol. The smile is like a fundamental symbol. It's something that we all kind of use to understand one another, and it's probably the most fundamental part of human communication is the facial expression. So effectively now what's happening is without the designers of the algorithms really being aware of it or the photographer being aware of it, the computer is going and basically rearranging the facial expressions. And I think that's slightly different than just adjusting parameters of the photograph.
How about the results, though? Your wife like her smile in the photograph? I mean, how did you guys look?
We both look fine. Our faces, looking at the photo itself, were probably a little creeped out. But in the photo, we looked fine. But, you know, I think the more troubling thing is that I'm sure that there are photos that Google may be automatically rearranging that aren't really meant to be rearranged, where having a smile is kind of inappropriate. I can imagine that a smile being put on in just the wrong moment might be a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. So this rewriting of history, it all looks a lot smilier.
Yeah, but is that really what we want? We all want a happy, smiling picture of every moment we've ever photographed.
Yeah, and in the future, nobody's going to know the truth of that.
Yes, and I saw Gone Girl over the weekend. And
I was thinking
smile,
of exactly the same yes. thing. So describe the scenario, if you would.
Well, in Gone Girl, one of the worst moments that happens is that the troubled husband, when his wife is missing, is giving the nervous speech you give when you're in front of a big crowd of people and the police and that sort of thing. And somebody from the crowd yells, "Give us a smile," and he smiles. And then that photo, of course, appears in the newspaper, which makes him look completely like a creep.
Well, I'm assuming your wife is not going to disappear in any time.
I'm hoping not. And if she does, boy, this interview is going to sound really, really strange.
So have you turned Auto Awesome off?
No. I kind of like to see what these things do. So I'll continue to let Auto Awesome do even more strange things to my photos in the future, I'm sure.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing them, Robert.
Well, it's been nice talking to you about it.
Robert Elliott Smith, teaching fellow at University College in London. He's in the Department of Computer Science. He wrote an essay on his blog called "It's Official, AIs Are Now Rewriting History." And you can read it and see those photographs for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Surveys about human fears consistently put public speaking at the top. And that's above death, by the way. Even harder than speaking in front of a crowd is taking the stage to publicly admit defeat. We heard plenty of that this week from the country's losing political candidates, who after months of campaigning had to gracefully admit loss in front of their disappointed supporters.
You've got no business in politics unless you respect the judgment of the people. If you run for office, you've got to be able to take it either way. I accept the decision of the voters, and I have already offered my sincerest congratulations and good wishes to Senator Shaheen.
U.S. Senate hopeful Scott Brown there, conceding defeat to Senator Jeanne Shaheen in Tuesday's midterm elections. So what makes a winning concession speech, if we may ask? Well, we can when talking to in-house presidential historian Brady Carlson. We took the opportunity when speaking with Brady for our Election Day show on winners and losers. You may know him as NHPR's host of All Things Considered, but he's also hard at work on a forthcoming book called Dead Presidents, An American Adventure. My conversation with Brady began with perhaps the most quoted sore loser speech in American political history.
I leave you, gentlemen, now, and you will now write it, you will interpret it, that's your right. But as I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Richard Nixon there, and who would be go on to be kicked around and do some kicking himself for some time. So what's the story there, Brady? What was he talking about?
Well, he was talking to the press, which, of course, is ironic because we all remember the warm feelings that the press and Nixon had for each other. This particular speech was in 1962. Nixon had lost the presidential race in 1960. 2 years later, he ran for governor of California, and he lost that race to the incumbent Edmund Pat Brown, whose son is now governor of California. And as he congratulates Brown, he starts noting all of the things that he's proud of in doing in the race. And as he notes each of these things, he says, now, of course, you didn't report that, and you didn't report that, and you didn't report that. So he's turning his concession speech into kind of an indictment of the media and the way it was covering his campaign, which he thought was highly unfair. So he said after these two big losses, he was politically finished, and he said, the reporters are going to miss me when I'm gone.
He said it was his last press conference ever. So it's a memorable concession speech.
Highly.
Any standout concession speeches, either historic or contemporary?
There was a famous concession speech actually in New Hampshire during our presidential primary in 1988. This was a Republican contest between Vice President George H.W. Bush and Kansas Senator Bob Dole. Bush won that race, and it was very contentious. And when asked if he had anything to say to Bush about the vote, Dole growled, yeah, tell him to stop lying about my record.
But couldn't we make the argument, Brady, that that is somehow more honest? You know, I mean, we think about the campaign season, all these slings and arrows and barbs and accusations and animosity exchanged between the candidates.
And then all of a sudden they're being nice to each other.
Pling, you know, I called my honorable opponent and, you know, offered my congratulations, you know, then they're all gracious about it.
Yeah, I think it has to do with the fact that for the people who aren't winners in these races, this is their last chance to speak to their prospective constituents. And in most cases, you want to put a good face on that, especially if you're thinking 2 or 4 years down the road that you might be back. You don't want to leave people with the image that that then Vice President Nixon left in 1962, where it was a very, you know, he sounded bitter and he sounded upset and he sounded a little too angry for people's tastes. You basically don't want to give people an excuse to not vote for you or not like you somewhere else down the road. And even in Nixon's case, it worked out in the end. After 6 years, he wound up running again and as the new Nixon and ended up being president.
Okay, so let's hear a sore loser. This is former New Jersey gubernatorial candidate Barbara Buono. She lost in that race to Governor Chris Christie, who, let's say, outpaced her by many, many points even going into the race.
The Democratic political bosses, some elected and some not, made a deal with this governor, despite him representing everything they're supposed to be against. They didn't do it to help the state. They did it out of a desire to help themselves politically and financially.
Okay, so that's not such a great concession speech. She's blaming her own party for her loss. How about memorable, good, heartwarming, gracious concession speeches?
Sometimes these concession speeches really can convince you that even in the nastiest of political campaigns, sometimes there's still something good going on in the American political system. I mean, most recently, there was the example of 2008 when John McCain won a lot of praise for his concession speech in the presidential race. McCain pointed out that this was a historic election, that Barack Obama, an African-American, was now going to be president of the United States. And he was thinking just about a century before that, the incumbent president, Teddy Roosevelt, had invited Booker T. Washington to the White House. And there was a firestorm of controversy just about having that the president had lunch at the White House with an African-American. And here there was going to be an African-American who lived in the White House. And he was pointing out that no matter who you supported, that was a really big and exciting moment for the country.
America today
is a world away from the cruel and prideful bigotry of that time. There is no better evidence of this than the election of an African American to the presidency of the United States. Let there be no reason now. Let there be no reason now for any American to fail to cherish their citizenship in this, the greatest nation on earth.
John McCain there, keeping it classy in 08 during his concession speech. Brady, it reminds me, did you see that movie, the Netflix documentary Mitt, that followed Mitt Romney on his campaign for president?
No, I didn't see it.
Okay, because there's a moment in there where they're at his hotel room and he's surrounded by his family, and it strikes him that he's not even thought. He so thought he was going to win that he didn't even consider writing a concession speech. Let's listen to a clip from that.
So what do you say if we, what do you think you say in a concession speech? Let me read you what I have here at Susan. Thank you. Just called President Obama to congratulate him on his victory. His supporters and his campaign also deserve congratulations. I wish all of them well, particularly the president, the first lady, and their daughters. This is a time of great challenges for America, and I pray that the president will be successful in guiding the nation.
I was following.
You know, everybody just looks dazed and blank, which I guess on some level could bring that kind of idea of thinking like a winner, you know, so positively that you don't even consider that you might lose.
Yeah, if you're spending time writing the speech about what happens when you lose, you're not spending time trying to win the election. I mean, everybody thought that Harry Truman in 1948 was behind in his bid for re-election against the Republican candidate, the governor of New York, Thomas Dewey. But Truman said, I'm getting to work. I'm not conceding a single vote, and I'm not writing a concession speech. And he ended up winning. There was that famous moment where he got off the train in Chicago and he held up the famously wrong headline of the Tribune that said Dewey defeats Truman. He figures, well, I don't have time to write a concession speech.
Okay, so after the concession speech, you're just a loser walking among us. And I hate to say it like that, but in politics, you have winners and losers. How about happy losers? Anybody really benefit from not becoming president?
Some candidates have actually walked away from the process and found a whole new life after politics that they've wound up enjoying more. The classic example that comes to mind for me is William Howard Taft. He ran for re-election against his former mentor, friend, and former president, Theodore Roosevelt, and the Democrat Woodrow Wilson. Wilson wound up winning the election. And Taft, of those three candidates, finished a distant third. And he joked not long after the election, he says, I've been elected ex-president by the largest margin in history. And he actually found that being outside of politics agreed with him very much. His health improved. He lost a lot of weight. He spent a lot of time teaching at law schools. Then he ended up getting the job that he really always wanted instead of the presidency. He wound up being Chief Justice of the United States. So he wound up enjoying himself very much. He even reconciled with Teddy Roosevelt in time.
Teddy Roosevelt, however, not such a graceful loser.
Not particularly. Not when a man says things like, we stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord. You don't give up that easily.
Any other beautiful losers?
John Quincy Adams had a very difficult presidency. John Quincy Adams won the White House in a very contested election over Andrew Jackson, who then vowed that the election had been stolen and that he would spend every waking moment trying to ruin Adams's presidency, which he did. Adams lost the rematch to Jackson, but he very quickly found a new niche as a member of Congress from Massachusetts. He wound up being kind of an early anti-slavery voice in the country. He was, by virtue of being a former president, able to say things that a lot of other politicians couldn't say. So there was a gag rule that they refused. At that time, the House had refused to even consider any bills about slavery. Adams got that lifted. He was the lawyer in the Supreme Court case, in the Amistad case, where the escaped slaves wound up winning their freedom and wound up becoming a very esteemed figure who wound up loving the combat, so to speak, of politics at that level instead of being somewhat out of it, isolated in the White House.
Well, you know, when we talk about partisanship in American politics, a lot of people go back to the election of 1876. Now, Brady, maybe it's too soon to really dig into this one.
Well, this one makes the 1876 election made the Bush v. Gore contest in 2000 look very mild-mannered. There was talk at some point that we might have a second civil war because the election got so crazy. There was vote rigging and stealing and all kinds of nefarious activity going on between the Republicans Republican candidate Rutherford B. Hayes and the Democrat Samuel Tilden. In the end, Rutherford B. Hayes wound up winning, and that's why we remember his beard and we remember nothing about Samuel Tilden, even though Tilden won the popular vote. Tilden liked to joke later on that he had the benefit of having won the presidency without ever having to have the responsibilities of serving. But there is a slight bitter note because his grave in New York State has a very pointed epitaph that says, "I still trust the people."
Brady Carlson, NHPR's All Things Considered host, he's currently on deadline to deliver his forthcoming book. It is called Dead Presidents, an American Adventure. It just hasn't been published yet. We have a list of our memorable winners, losers, and concession speeches at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for listening today. If you missed any segment or if you'd like to share something with a friend, you can download the Word of Mouth podcast from iTunes. It's also available at wordofmouthradio.org or on the NHPR app. You can also get in touch with us or share your ideas for the program on facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, on Twitter @wordofmouth, or on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. We find the best ideas move around by word of mouth, so let us hear yours. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
And it's hanging from a pigeon wing. Get right if you can't relate. Trade the cash for the beat, for the body, for the hate. And my time is a piece of wax falling on a termite who's choking on the splinters. So